view of the triangular trade on the 14th and 15th council website looks like that. The manufactured goods came from Bristol, this is the Bristol orientated view of things. Went down to Africa, where they traded for slaves, who went across to the Caribbean islands, but also throughout the whole colonial system in the Americas. And then in return, they brought back cotton, tobacco, and sugar, and brought other products as well. That's kind of the simplified version of the trade, called the triangular trade, but it was much more complex than that. But we're not going to get into that tonight. But it was very, very complex trade. It wasn't just a follow the trade routes. That's the trade we're talking about when we talk about the slave trade, if you like. So Britain and other European countries had to make goods to sell to trade on the African coast. They then got the slaves, the labour, took it over to the Caribbean, took it over to the Americas, used that to harvest and exploit the natural resources of those countries, those colonies, and bring it back to Britain and other European countries where it was processed in manufactories. And in fact, the Caribbean and the United States, as it became, were not allowed to set up industry in their countries. They weren't allowed to develop. They could only provide the mother country, like, with natural resources. In fact, they were actually prohibited against setting up their own manufactories. The official campaign to end the British slave trade began in 1787. A lot of that was done by Clarkson, who is commemorated in Bristol, the colleague of Wilberforce, collecting first-hand reports from sailors, a great personal risk. And immediately after that, there was a thing called the Dolbins Act, which limited the number of slaves on ships. This is the first sort of reform of the slave trade. For every 3 ton of the weight of the ship, the displacement of the ship, you could have 5 slaves, and then up to 200 tons, and then 1 slave for every additional ton thereafter, and a surgeon had to be on the ship as well. And then the French Revolution came along, which completely transformed things around the world. And this created a big crisis for the British state, and just the abolition of the slave trade was put on hold while they sorted out their internal population, because they were obviously scared there was going to be a revolution in Britain as well. King George had his head chopped off. So all these things happened at the same time. This is after the Dolbin Act, just to give you an idea so we can stay in touch with what the slave trade actually meant. These are the ships owned by James Rogers after the Act, after certain improvements have been made. The Rodney ship in 1791, 78 out of 371 Africans on board died. The same ship, 2 years later, 61 African people died on it. The same year, 89 Africans died. And then when it landed in the Caribbean, 10 slaves had to be sold immediately because they were about to die. The Pearl, another of James Rogers' ships, is a Bristol slave trader. In 1792, 116 out of 472 Africans died. Same ship, same year, 260 out of 400 people died. And then the Jupiter, in 1798, 170 people out of 390 died on the ship. Many of these were elderly women and children. It was a very inefficient slave trader. The crew of one of the ships was described as the biggest drunken thieving villains on earth.
and the master not fit for the task. And one of his surgeons was described as a drunken rascal, and another too fond of the liquor to expect any good.
They didn't give a shit.
And when we talk about the slave trade, we talk about hundreds and hundreds of people dying. One slave dying for every 20 shillings. Okay, the Bailey anti-abolitionist family were agents for Rogers, the owner of all those ships we just talked about, in Grenada and St. Vincent. He was a partner of the Bailey, a partner of the Baileys in St. Vincent. Barbados and the Pearl, which is one of Rogers' ships, arrived from Bonny in Africa. He refused to have anything to do with the cargo of slaves when he heard that 80 slaves had died during the disorder that broke out when the ship arrived from the Caribbean. People were still fighting, even though they'd come out all the way across the Atlantic in atrocious conditions. They still rose up on the ship and fought against the sailors and had to be subdued. The revolution in France in 1793, shockwaves through the whole British business sector, credit was called in, and Rogers went bust. The people of France had a direct influence on the ceasing of the trade in slaves. People were rising up and fighting the establishment. Europe had to take stock of what it was doing to people around the world. A big wake-up call for them. Because instead of slaves dying, the aristocracy was dying. They were getting their heads cut off. You know, a lot of sentiment about the trundling along in the guillotine and all the rest of it. Yeah. 170 people out of 390. 260 out of 400 people died. That's why the aristocracy had their head cut off. To end all that absolute horror people had living. So, this is what the orthodox view of the abolition of slavery is. George III. Whereas the two houses of the Parliament did, by their resolutions on the 10th and 24th days of June 1806, severally resolve upon certain grounds therein mentioned, that they would all, with all practical expedition, take effectual measures for the abolition of the African slave trade. Great moment in human history that people fought for. You've gone the wrong way. Here we go. 14 years earlier, in 1792, the Danish king had declared the end of the Danish slave trade before Britain. Yeah? And that was to end on the 1st of January, 1803. So 3 years ago, presumably, people in Denmark were having meetings like this to commemorate 200 years of the abolition of the slave trade in Denmark. Before Britain. Before all this stuff was pouring out of the media. Before then. They were the first European nation to abolish the slave trade. Slavery in the Danish West Indian colonies was abolished after a rebellion in 1848. The slaves rose up from the colonies. And they couldn't be subdued. And the slavery was abolished in those four islands that Denmark had. And in 1917, they were sold to the USA, and they're now called the US Virgin Islands. The three islands were St. Thomas, which they captured in 1660, St. John, 1718, and St. Croix, 1733. You see the Danish flag on the ship, just like you see lots of, you know, you recently see lots of portrayal of British ships. It's the European trade. Of course, although the abolition of the slave trade ended, there were still slaves, and even after the abolition of slavery, there was still a period of apprenticeship, which previous slave owners wanted to enforce. So the ending of the slave trade in 1806 is not the end of slavery by any means. So that's the background of the slave trade. Harrowing time. And every time we talk about these people, these masters in this book, that's what we're talking about. It's not an academic subject. It's people like us. People like you and me, taken and enslaved. Yeah, got quite upset. Anyway, cotton and weaving in the 18th century Bristol. In the 17th century, cotton goods were imported into Britain from India. This is the 1600s. In 1700, the British state faced an embargo on the import of cotton goods because they wanted to protect the English woolen industry. And English wool had been the staple of the whole British economy for centuries. It was being undermined by imports of cotton. Cotton became very popular. And a home-based cotton industry sprung up using colonial slave-grown cotton. Much of the cotton came from New England and the West Indies. And it came to the ports on the west coast of Britain, the newest ports. And the cotton industries grew up alongside those ports, like Liverpool, Manchester. You know, the Manchester cotton industry grew up with direct relationship to Liverpool. And the Bristol cotton industry grew up because Bristol was a port. The woolen linen manufacturers imposed restrictions to import cotton, but as it became more and more popular, they couldn't stop the trend towards cotton clothing, and wool became less of an article of clothing than cotton. Wool and linen. And cotton especially took over when the factory system took over during the 1700s. Run through the first English Industrial Revolution, which was the cotton industry. Okay. In 1733, the flying shuttle was invented by John Kay, an agency, a man, who was generally a man who did the weaving. Yeah. And he sat there with a loom, and he's throwing the shuttle through, you know, across, rather than doing it by hand, weaving by hand, he just put the western weave, that's it. And you throw it through, then it go the other way, and you put the shuttle back again. And that was a very, very quick way of weaving. That was 1733. And then the same year, the spinning jenny was invented by James Hargreaves. It's kind of thing I did it at school. Anybody else do all this at school? Yeah. Same year. So this is you've just had an improvement in the speed of weaving, and this is an improvement in the speed of providing the cotton to keep up with the pace of the weaving. Yeah. No point in having really efficient weaving if you can't get a supply of cotton. So this could spin 8 threads of cotton yarn without using a foot pedal. Faster production of weaving because it could keep up with the weaver's supplies. And both the flying shuttle and the spinning jenny were small enough to use at home. And these weren't in factories, these were in people's houses, these machines. So you can see, it's just like the spinning wheel, like the wool, you know, teasing the wool out and spinning and making yarn that way. This was with a machine. And then Richard Arkwright's Waterford, going back to your O-level history here, 1769, the Waterford allowed for larger spinning machines and got powers from water mills. Yeah. So where women were working at home and spinning, you couldn't have a water wheel next to your house. You had to go to a mill and you had to work in the mill. And people were divided. Women had to go and work and do the spinning in a mill, and men increasingly were left at home doing the weaving. So there was a division of labour, and that was accentuated because they had to actually work in different places. And there he is, Mr. Arkwright himself is looking very smug and typical kind of Georgian businessman. That is a great photograph. Painting. That's later. And there's his water frame. Yeah, you see the belt going around, driven by the water wheel. No guard on it. So. Very, very dangerous places to work. Lose your finger, lose your leg. The kids working there, and women. Then it was the same year. Yeah? So just like the spinning journey, etc., happened in 1733, in 1769, there were two Ural spinning and weaving advances. And this was the power loom. And the first true factory in England was established at Cromford, near Derby, by Cartwright. In the 1790s, weavers worked at home and they were really, really well paid. They were, the top job for a weaver. Everybody needed clothing. By 1810, many of these weavers had become labourers in factories and replaced by machines like that. Give you an idea how rapidly it happened. In 1833, there were 2,400 power looms across Britain. That's those machines there. That's 1813. By 1815, there were 250,000. Massive change. Now, Bristol was a weaving centre. If you go up the Fleece and Firkin over the river, where the Fleece and Firkin is your wool market. And all that area of Redcliffe was the woolen area where the wool was traded. And other stuff as well. James Watt, there he is, improved the steam engine. And this was the first step towards railways. The steam engine also drove all these industrial machines. So 1769, the height of the slave trade, right, the height of the power of Bristol. Did the Bristol weavers accept this lying down?
No.
Did they accept it lying down?
No.
No, they bloody did not. Most of the weavers lived outside the city gate, Lawford's Gate. You know, anybody know where Lawford's Gate is? St. Jude's, yeah. If you go through Old Market and then go towards Easton, there used to be a big gate there, and that was Lawford's Gate, that was the edge of the city. It's still called Lawford's Gate, that little road. The whole big cafe and CSD. So they lived outside the city. Proper. Towards Easton. In 1726, 27, Wiltshire weavers came to Kingswood and asked the miners to give them assistance in their industrial dispute, i.e., they asked the miners to come along with big clubs and beat the hell out of the people who were introducing these big machines. The miners did a lot of that in Kingswood. In 28, 500 workmen living in the area of Lawford's Gate destroyed and burned 30 looms before proceeding to Chew Magnet, Tensford, Kensham, where they attacked more looms and pulled down the house. Did you accept it lying down?
No, they did not.
1729, serious disturbances broke out amongst the weavers who lived outside of Lawford's Gate. Many looms were torn out of employers' houses and were destroyed. The house was demolished and the soldiers sent to deal with the disturbance were beaten off by the weavers. Same year, starving weavers, gathered outside the Castle Ditch, which is the edge of the town, and marched on the house Stephen Feacham, who paid too low a rate of pay. Feacham shot 8 protesters, killing 2. The troops fired on the protesters using blank ammunition to try and scare them away. Feacham was pardoned for the murders, but the 2 weavers were executed. Bristol people. 3 years later, they didn't forget old Feachum, and made an effigy of him, dressed him in a shroud when he was out of town, is it? And they paraded this through Lawford's Gate before hanging it on a gibbet in Lambs Fields. And this, if you ever go around St. Jude's, there's a little thing called Lamb Street. Mm. That's how the group. And that's where Lambs Field was, going down the River Froom. Where there was a big works. When the city watched, that's the police, trying to cut down the guy, the weavers beat arms in the frying pan and collected money so they could mount a permanent guard on the effigy. And a good time as that day. Yeah, they needed the money because they needed some beer, probably. We still do donations, don't we, Roger?
Yeah.
We've got the frying pan out in a minute. So, to recap. Alright. Before the growth of the factory system, the textile industry was confined to the home. It was known as the domestic system. Families were responsible for every stage of the process, turning raw cotton, drawn by a slave, into fabric. The work moved out of the home into factories, and those who had traditionally been involved in every stage of the process now worked on one area. The division of labour was broken down, not just male and female, but down to specific jobs. Many were overseeing machines, just working the machines, make sure the thread didn't break, putting on new reams of cotton, rather than working by hand. So it had become factory-based, and eventually concentrated in the Great Western Cotton Works of Barton Hill. You all know where Barton Hill is? Anybody not know where Barton Hill
is? Nothing, is it?
Oh no, brilliant. It's in Bristol. But we'll move on to that later. Okay, that's a quick run through the first Industrial Revolution. It wasn't only in Bristol where people revolted against the factory system. In 1811, any person who breaks or destroys machinery in any mill used in preparing or spinning of wool or cotton or any other material, or the use of stocking or lace manufacture, or being lawfully convicted, shall suffer death. Okay. Anybody who broke one of those machines suffered death, the death penalty. Rather familiar to the kind of orders that were given out to the colonies. That's the same bloody people giving the same bloody orders. Why did poor Bristolians vote in 1831? You've all heard of the 1831
uprising,
reform revolt. Yeah, it certainly wasn't a riot. It was an organised uprising by local people. Which is totally cheap. Anybody not heard of it? 1831. Significant, yeah.
Is that the same as that of Bristol?
Yeah. one of many. Okay. Massive outpouring of anger in Bristol in 1831. And that, one of the reasons was, in part, not only did men and women have to work in factories, but so did their children. 1819 to 1833, children aged 9 to 11, this is the Factory Act, worked a legal maximum of 72 hours a week, that's 12 hours a day if they had somebody on. And we don't have many factory inspectors now, and I do think there were even less then to enforce these laws, because there's no upper limit for adults. So children in Bristol working in these factories and elsewhere in the country, 12 hours a day. Family value is good, isn't it? 9 years. The Factory Act after that reduced the working age to 8. And so, 1831 and all that. Okay, that's what happened. There you go. That's Queen Square. The marsh, oops, and they set the town on fire, yeah. Destroyed a lot of stuff. In 1831, only 6,000 people out of 1,004 were eligible to vote. And that's what sparked off the rebellion, the reborn rebellion. The 31st of all, October 1831, a large revolt against the decision of the House of Lords to defeat the Reform Act. And then one of those lords, who was a magistrate, came to Bristol, visited Bristol. And the people rose up against him. His people were denied the vote, and any influence at all over any aspect of their daily lives. And all they could do, through frustration, was attack. 100 houses were burnt down, including the Bishop's Palace. So you think the Bishop's Palace, anybody? Doubt it, it's not there.
Next to the cathedral?
It was next to the cathedral, yeah, near around where the library is.
They had a go at the cathedral, weren't they?
They had a go at the cathedral, and they were that close to getting into the cathedral, that close, and they just slammed the door in town and put the bolt on and stopped people getting in. Otherwise, the cathedral would have gone up as well. The custom house as well in Queen Square and the mansion house, where the mayor used to, the mayor's residence was, that was burned down as well.
Where was that?
I know where it is now. The mansion house is up where Mr. Pinney built his house up on the edge of the Downs. But the original one, I can't remember, it might have been in Queen Square. Was it? Yeah. Queen Square was the centre of it. They liberated all the wine from the cellars. This is not long after the French Revolution. Right? The dragoons were called in and attacked, and hundreds of Bristolians were killed or severely wounded. Charles Pinney was the mayor of Bristol at this time, and we will come up with the Pinney family very shortly. He was responsible for that. There have been many other citizens' revolts as well in Bristol. 1685, there was a foiled uprising, the Monmouth Rebellion, which was a full-scale invasion by the Duke of Monmouth to overthrow the king in 1685, stop the glorious revolution which happened. Yeah. And the army, the Monmouth's army, came all the way up through the south and got as far as Keynsham. And there was a bit of a mix-up with the signals for them to take Bristol. Some explosions went off too early, and so all the signals got mixed up, and so they went round Bristol and were finally defeated just further north. But the Pinney family was involved in that. The Pinney family, major slave owner, major rich person they were at Bristol. And Mr. Pinney was exiled from the country for his part in the Monmouth Rebellion. And Mr. Pinney was a rebel, and Charles Pinney was responsible for the death and wounding of hundreds of people in Queen Square for rebelling. In 1709, there was the Food Rebellion, which was having enough food. In 1714, there was a huge political revolt. Yeah, this is just 50 years after the English Revolution. The Weavers' Revolt, which we told about, which went on for 6 years. The Turnpike Revolt, which went on for a majestic 22 years, they tried to impose tolls on the gates of Bristol and elsewhere. There was a massive rising against that right across the country, and especially in Wales. And they couldn't collect tolls on at Lawford's Gate, at where the Three Blackbirds are in on St. Paul's, the toll gate there, the toll gate on Warwick Road. Now the entrance to St. Paul's, pretty much. The toll gates are all around the city, and the managers kept coming up with their coal and set fire to the gates. Yeah. And then were pursued by soldiers. Kingswood, which is now where Easton is, was completely unruleable. The city was okay on its own, could rule the city, but outside the city walls it was a free-for-all, really. Then there was the Second Food Rebellion, over bread, and then there was the Bristol Bridge Massacre in 1793, which was also when they tried to reimpose the toll on the Bristol Bridge, which is the bridge that goes from kind of Wine Street to
one of the civic stories through.
Still there, really. All those, apart from the Bristol Bridge Massacre, were people coming into the town from outside, out of the city. What started to happen with the Bristol Bridge Massacre and then the 1831 was that the actual population of Bristol rebelling, rather than people like the miners coming in from Kingswood, etc., demanding rights. Feelings ran high in the city. So we're talking about the 1831 again. Feelings ran high in the city over the question of slavery. There was an especially violent election campaign in 1830, the year before. There were two Whig candidates, that's like the Liberal Party candidates, if you like. There's against the Tory. There were only two parties, the Whigs and the Tories. The Whigs had two candidates, there weren't any Tory candidates. Lord Talbot. Edward Prothero, his family traded in the Caribbean as a slaver, and promoted emancipation, freedom of slaves. And then James Evan Bailey, remember Bailey, the agent for Rogers, with all those ships? Mm-hmm. That family lived in Queen Square. They actually had 2,000 slaves, and would you believe they were against slave freedom? And Bailey, who brought racism in Britain up to a new height during the election campaign, Rawdon became the MP for Bristol. And local poor people must have seen this as a big setback in their ambitions, because very much tied in the freedom of slavery is freedom of people within their own within Britain to gain more freedoms and gain more rights, especially the right to vote. And then came 1831, the very next year, and the Lords vote against extending that very vote. The night before the 31 revolt, hundreds of sledgehammers were borrowed from Akram's iron foundry at Bathurst Basin. It's not actually an apostrophe in there, the name is Akram's. And we'll come across Mr. Akram later on. His hammers were used to break down the doors of four prisons in Bristol. And this fact was used later on in the whole inquiry and trial which happened to evidence prior planning by the mob. And they did plan. They did plan. They knew that guy was coming. They knew what had happened afterwards. And they revolted against that decision in the only way they could. The hammers were recreated by the Bristol Rank and Bristol Rank History Week, were they not, Roger?
Yeah, they were not.
There you go. At a forging Easter. Yeah? And there's an example of what the hammers were like. And we're not talking one or two hammers, we're talking hundreds of hammers. One person per hammer, that's hundreds of people walking around with big sledgehammers, breaking down doors and taking all the goods out of people's houses, etc. It's a full-scale local revolt. Such was the impact of that revolt in Bristol that it sent alarms ringing all around the country. And in the Weekly Messenger in London, just after it, was this: the King was so anxious for the safety of the docks in London from the rabble in London, because they'd been defeated as well with the extension of the vote. Because they thought they would imitate what happened in Bristol in London, that local people would break out to acts of riot, that His Majesty wrote to the Governor of Greenwich Hospital desiring him to send 200 pensioners to each of the docks. And 400 pensioners also sent, at the insistence of His Majesty, to Chatham to relieve the Marines who were there. Yeah, the official army were there, because they'd been removed near to Woolwich, which is right next to the arsenal, where all the guns and gunpowder were stored. The Marines had to go over there. The pensioners had to go and guard the docks. The army had to go and guard the arsenal in case of a disturbance in the metropolis. People making an impact on social happenings and what was occurring in the country. People in Bristol did that.
Meanwhile, in the West Indies and America, it's also 1831. Yeah. Give you an idea of what the masters in the plantations and the colonies were facing. In Jamaica, the white inhabitants, this is in 1787, they're all just prior to 1780, when there was an audit done. This is from the Almanac on the Jamaican history website. In Jamaica, there were 23,000 white inhabitants and 256,000 black inhabitants. Yeah. And also, they've got 4,000 free black inhabitants. I don't know if they are slaves who have been given their freedom or acquired their freedom but still lived in society, or whether they were the Maroons, or the Camden Maroons, who were free slaves in the centre of Jamaica.
I don't know. Maroon.
Yeah.
Maroon.
I don't know if that number is the number of Maroons or a number of slaves who have been given their freedom. I didn't say. But yeah. So the white inhabitants were outnumbered. It was a ratio of 1 to 11. And in Antigua, which I just highlighted because we'll touch on Antigua later, they were outnumbered 1 to 6. And in Nevis, which was where Pini had his plantations, they were outnumbered 1 to 10. You see in Granada, 1 to 24, 1 to 12, 1 to 8. In Barbados, there's 1 to 4. In the Bahamas, there's 1 to 1. There's an idea. And they're outnumbered at home as well, in Bristol. By a similar kind of ratio. So they're fighting two places at the same time. Yeah. Constantly worried by revolt, because of constant revolts. We've got the display going around here showing constant revolts all around the colony. And in 1831, all year in Trinidad, there were a planned series of revolts. This was over the markets, the right for slaves to have a market, a day off where you can sell your own produce and earn some money. But they do say that those revolts in 1831 was the origins of the carnival. That's the theory, that carnival happened because of those demonstrations, because of people going out on the streets and demonstrating and campaigning for their rights. In March the same year in Antigua, remember Antigua? Happened with 1-6. There were arson attacks and battles with the militia. I mean, this is just this one year. In August, there was Nat Turner's revolt in Virginia, which was a major, major turnaround in the United States, that revolt. 70 slaves killed, 57 whites, and marched on the county town of Jerusalem. They were met by troops and militia and were slaughtered. And then Nat Turner and 18 rebels were hung, but their actions spread such an ease amongst the establishment in the U.S. that it brought around change in attitude and a change of opinion about the whole slave issue in the United States. So although they died, their impact continued. Still in 1831, in Jamaica, with the Emancipation Rebellion in Western Jamaica involving 20,000 slaves led by Sam Sharp, who planned a general strike. And then there was extensive destruction and insurrection. The states and sugar works were set on fire. 750 slaves and 14 free persons put on trial and convicted to death. Or they got 200 to 500 lashes. What's called a severe flogging.
Killing them.
That's about right. Sam Sharp was executed and he said, "I would rather die on yonder gallows than live in slavery." This happened just after the Bristol riots, and we've just been talking about the two places are linked by the ships, linked by the sailors, and communications happen. Sailors talk to people in Bristol. They know
that there's insurrections being planned. They know what's going on. And that inspired the people of Britain to fight against the same masters, because they must have seen it as an opportunity. Because they know that people can't fight in two places at the same time.
No,
no
pensioners to go around.
No pensioners to go around, exactly. Yeah, no, the king was poo-pooing himself.
Great question.
Yeah.
You often hear that a lot of the landlords, the landowners of the colonies are actually at home.
Hmm.
So I mean, I just wondered what proportion, they must have been talking about it here.
Hmm.
The big landowners weren't, they weren't about being over there, did they?
Yeah.
They had other people doing it. Yeah. I just wondered, is there any figures about the proportion of the ones that are actually here?
It was massive. Absentee landlordism was huge on the estates, and the agents that they used to run the estates took out of control. They had no inhibitions whatsoever, they were just out of control people who flogged, beat, and just tried through force to get as much labour out of people as was possible without looking after them in any way, shape, just extracting value from every last ounce of that. So the background of heavy-duty insurrections, both at home and on the plantations, Bristol and other slave owners across the country, and I think, how can we get out of the use of slave labour and at the same time make sure we cash in on any deal we arrange with the British state over the next 2 years, prior to the actual freedom of the slaves? So they are thinking of their way out. They won't get out of it. The whole system is completely outdated, completely discredited, out of control. Haiti had gone up in flames. The French had been defeated in Haiti, etc., etc. There's revolution all over Europe. They can't handle it any longer. The whole mercantile system is finished. And right there, coming up on the horizon, there's a second industrial revolution, and they wanted to get involved in that. And they didn't give a damn, like you said, absentee landlords. They didn't give a damn what happened in the colonies. They didn't care. They just wanted wealth. It didn't matter. They'd gone down to the depths of humanity, degradation. They didn't care where they got that wealth from. They didn't care if 270 slaves out of 420 died on the ship. So long as there was money at the end of it. The least money to spend on people, the better. Yeah. So, 20 million quid. They're fixed up. 20 million quid in 1833. West Indian lobby in Harwich arranged that. Of which, the merchant ventures were the Bristol contingent. In 1835, Britain had a national debt of £8 million. Yeah.
Do you know the present day equivalent of the 20 million?
Yeah, I'll come on that in a minute. I haven't actually worked. It's a bit of a thing about the 20 million, about trying to compare money 200 years ago with money now. Even if you get the relative value, you know, I mean, this is multi million pounds now. Because it has a different purchasing power now. You know, there were very fewer commodities then. You know, so money meant power much more than, say, even Branston has now. You know, in Britain, you know, he's a lot of money, but his power is diluted because there's so much money around the world. You know, it's kind of a relative thing. Then they were autonomous. You know, they were complete lords. They were the aristocracy. And it was I've thought a lot about whether to put those figures up, but I'll put it up for individuals. So Britain had a national debt. £20 million was the equivalent of 40%. Of the gross tax revenue from the state during the time when it was given out to the slave owners. So that kind of gives an idea of its proportion.
40% of the tax revenue now.
Which is what is spent on the public sector now.
Yeah.
40%.
Yeah.
All of the public
sector. All that money going to private individuals. So they couldn't raise it through tax. Political suicide, to be a revolution, to try to levy a tax on the people to pay slave owners. No one, you just think, this is 2 years after they had to go and send the Marines to guard the arsenal in London. This is after, hundreds of houses have been burnt down in Bristol, hundreds of guys walking around with sledgehammers. People were up for it. Couldn't do it, so they had to figure out another way of raising the money to pay themselves. So they negotiated with British finances, and they started with Rothschilds and Barings. Yeah, Barings Bank. Rothschilds Bank still in existence to raise £20 million. They all had to put in sealed bids, but in fact only Rothschilds put in a bid to raise the money. And then they had to go on the international money market, assisted in 1833, to raise the money to get the £20 million. And for every £100 that they raised internationally, they got government bonds, guaranteed 3% interest on government bonds. Rothschilds made money out of slaves, out of the school deal. That's probably what you put it. Claims were settled at the rate of 1,600 a week. It was a very efficient bureaucracy set up to deal with this processing of claims for all the thousands of slave owners that Britain had. All that to be done in London. I'll come up with that later. The detriment of the economy of the islands. The money was not sent to the islands or the colonies at all. It could have been. Treasury ships used to go from Britain to the islands, and they'd be armed ships with an armed escort going across with chests of money so they wanted to drain on coinage from the islands, coming back to Britain. They'd have to be sent back over again. And there was always a shortage of coinage. Planters and what have you used to create their own coinage, like they did in Bristol. And it would have transformed what happened in those colonies if that 20 million quid that had actually gone and been invested in people's lives and livelihoods and infrastructure. There were no roads in Jamaica. There were no roads. The only bit of Jamaica that was conquered was the outside. And because of all the bays in Jamaica, the planters never bothered building any roads because it was easy enough just to hop around the bays in Jamaica. So they never bothered building anybody else. There's no infrastructure, is there?
What advantage was there for Barings to raise that money? What's the interest
of that? Rothschild, they got the interest from the government, guaranteed interest. They got 3% on 20 million quid.
They raised the money and they got the interest.
Yeah, they got 3%, whatever that is, 20 million quid.
And the slave owners were demanding that they get compensation for the trade being finished.
Yeah. Well, no, not for the trade being finished. That had happened in 06. This is 33.
What were they being compensated for?
For the slaves getting their freedom. There was still slavery after the slave trade.
They would lose money if they, because they've got their freedom.
Yeah.
And they were given this money. The money they were given.
Yeah.
It's a bizarre thing, You enslave someone and you get compensated. You get compensated for their love and freedom. 30,000 people had an average of 3 slaves. 30,000 British people had but 3 slaves. And they found it difficult, especially if they had those slaves in the islands and the colonies, they found it difficult to come over to London, because you have to come to London to make a claim. The merchants and the bankers made sure that happened. So these small-scale slave owners were easy prey to those who bought their rights on the island. So, okay, you're not going to go, the other go. I'll buy your rights to claim the compensation at a knockdown price. And prior to 1833, because the major slave owners and the merchants were negotiating this deal, they knew it was coming, and they started buying up some of the more bankrupt plantations in the West Indies, so they could have more slaves to get more compensation. 1833. Complete and utter scandal. No which way you look. Compensation to owners, paid in London, as I said, insisted upon by the West Indian interest to keep money under their direct control. Not only were the landlords absent, but the plantations were mortgaged up to the hilt, and they were mortgaged in the growing British banking system, the banks in Bristol and elsewhere. And they kept on loaning the plantations money, especially in Jamaica and other islands where the soil was becoming more and more depleted because of single crop production. The soil was getting tired. And getting possession of the compensation money was what's called the great objective of all the people who had the mortgages. They didn't want the planters to get it. They didn't want, because they said we have first claim on it because they owe us the money. So they were hand in hand with the state. You know, there's no, you couldn't get a waiver between the government and the West Indian lobby. That was their great objective, to get that money. The merchant creditors kept any money due to them. They were therefore ideally positioned to control and invest and speculate their funds in Britain. The Bristol merchants and bankers invested it in Bristol. They were planning it all the while. Right from, for like 10 years, planning it. Get all of the money, use the established and modified institutions to channel the money where they thought it would most benefit themselves. Compensation paid to British owners, over £6 million to slavers in Jamaica, in Antigua again, £500,000, in Nevis, in Niger, £151,000. You can see they're all sort of listed there, and it adds up exactly £20 million. You see the slavers valued their slaves in about twice what they actually got.
Could you explain what the columns are?
These were the different islands in the West Indies. Yeah. That was the average value of the slave. A slave who did a different work. If you were a field slave, a house slave, if you were a carpenter, if you were a wheelwright, whatever the slaves were, they had a different value put on them. If you were male, female, of your age, you were valued differently. And these are the average values, the slaves of each island. This is the number of slaves. So on Jamaica, there were 311,000 slaves. The relative value, that's the value put on them by the slave owners, was, if they had to go out and buy them on the free market, it was 13 million. Need 14 million quid, and they got 6 million quid. And so it goes on.
Roughly
half what they said. It's 40 million quid. Completely bust the whole
thing.
What's the public opposition to compensation?
Well, yeah, there was, a lot of people said no, they shouldn't get the money, A lot of people said no, this place should be free, because everybody knew it was a car, but people, no power, couldn't even produce a newspaper, without paying a tax on it, it's made it prohibitive. It's complete carbo on the establishment. But it was a way of moving on. It was a way of getting rid of that system as far as the state was concerned, the British state was concerned, getting rid of it. Okay, we'll pay this really high price. Sugar's at its day, we're moving on to something else.
And what they actually said is, we're getting out of slaves and we're getting into sleepers. Railway sleepers. Yeah. Compensation in Bristol. Slaver merchants, Daubneys, the Braggs, the Vaughans, Caves, and the Properos. Remember that MP? We MP, Properos. We're all taking part in the anti-abolition movement. And we're well placed in the banking establishment. So, good advantage of their compensation payments. Bristol got £500,000, and that's, I've put a figure up there, that's about 25 million quid today. But it's much more than that, really.
Because you had pity. Getting money from the art and bringing it.
Well, you imagine the amount of money that was in circulation. That was a massive amount of capital to have. Massive. You can't see the land value of that. The Bailey family, remember the agents for Rogers? They got about 5.5 million quid. The Daniels, they had nearly 4,000 slaves. They got 117,000. Charles Pinney got over £36,000, almost 2 million back. People being free.
The Procurers, wasn't Edward Prothero for abolition?
Yeah, but he was still a slave owner.
He was still a slave owner.
He's fine because he could get the money.
it was the end of the system.
To get
the
back
system
out
was coming to an end. But he didn't just free his slaves.
Yeah.
They wanted to get the money. Yeah.
Did a lot of those slave merchants and good banking families become or join the abolition movement at the end? When the system was dying?
All those. All the banks and bonds, caves. They're all non-conformists. People like, they were like local loser forces. But still had slaves. They still.
Joined it to end it.
Yeah, these are people who were influential in the city, if you like. They were, if you like, leading figures. No more than that. The vast majority of people were against slavery per se and weren't going to get a penny out of it. It's rather revolted.
How
come
this family
was
only a 40th
of the 2 million? 20 million.
Yeah. 1/40th,
yeah.
Well, that's. It's
funny
that
Bristol
only had 1/40th.
Hmm.
Where did the rest of
the money go? Oh, London, Liverpool. I mean, that's probably had. Glasgow. Whitehaven, anywhere on the west coast, and London, Newcastle, everyone's all over. None of the slave owners who actually resided in colonies as well. And one of the reasons why they wanted to end is because sugar was becoming less important, and a lot of protection of the sugar price had been removed, the guaranteed price that sugar would be sold for in Britain. Big move towards opening up the markets and having freedom of trade, free trade ports, free trade. So it was in rapid decline. They wanted to get out before it was going to be worse. By 1871, no ship left Jamaica from Bristol. West Indian tonnage of goods was just 2% of the imports of Bristol. So it was in decline. And they were getting off. Off ship. Good sweet. So in 1834, Pearson acted that all and every person who shall be held in slavery within any British colony as aforesaid shall upon and from and after the said first day of August 1834 become to all intents and purposes free and discharged of and from all manner of slavery. Shall be absolutely and forever magnificent, free. So, declining trade, slave revolts, all the time. Massive unrest before. One of the reasons they got out of it. Not because they were great liberal people, because there's no money in it anymore.
On break, and then I thought you a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea.